A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast. With me, Caroline Foran, my guest this week, Scarlett Curtis, probably one of, if not the most, I've ever enjoyed recording a podcast. Scarlett Curtis, for those who don't know, what have you been doing with your life? She is the curator of the Sunday Times bestseller and National Book Award winning Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies, and the book It's Not Okay to Feel Blue and Other Lies, published by Penguin. She's also the daughter of Richard Curtis, who made Love Actually. She's actually in Love Actually. She was the second lobster. We have an amazing chat here about mental health, well-being, her experience of anxiety and depression, how she differentiates the two. We talk about the commoditization of self-care, society, cultural stigmas, so many things. I thoroughly enjoyed chatting to her and I learned a lot from Scarlett, and she just articulates things in such a brilliant way. So I hope you find it as good as I did and as helpful and as reassuring if you're someone who's struggling right now. It's okay to not be okay. It's okay to feel blue. Scarlett Curtis, it is such an honour to have you as a guest on Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast.
I'm so happy to be here. It is genuinely my favourite topic to talk about.
You can tell that you're so open and honest, and it really seems to be like quite a radical thing on social media. And I think it's so needed.
Yeah, it's so needed. And I think, you know, it's helped me. Like, I have no idea if it's helped anyone else, but it's helped me so much. Just kind of overcoming the shame that I felt about so much of this, because there still is so much shame around it. You know, we're making huge amounts of progress, but yeah, it's a tricky topic. And I think when you're open about it, it's the best thing I ever did for my own mental health, basically.
It really, for me, helped to take away the shame. And like, you just want someone else to say, oh yeah, me too, I feel that too. And I think that's so important. But the flip side of that, unbeknownst to yourself, is that you've probably, and definitely with your books and everything, helped hundreds of thousands of people to normalize their experience of anxiety. Because you're right, the stigma is still, we've come a long way, like you said, but it's still there. There's still a lot of shame around feeling like you're not okay. And I think for people after COVID as well, I think it's really kind of spiked. People maybe had never felt it before, and suddenly they're in this situation where their threat response is like constantly activated and they're like, what is this? And this is not okay, and I need to not feel this way. So now there's a lot more people who need to come to terms with the fact that they're human and they're vulnerable.
Yeah, completely. And I think something else that's been really hard about COVID and this post whatever COVID phase that we're in, even though it's not over, is that everyone's going through it. And so I think it's been very hard for people to ask for help, even if that was something you were already comfortable doing. It's been very hard to ask for help from family or friends or community, because you know that we're all going through some version of this. Me and my friends used to always say, like, only one of us can be down at once. Yeah. So that we can all help. And I think the toughest thing about the last few years is that we've all kind of been down all the time, or, you know, a lot of the time.
So take me back to the beginning for you. Has anxiety always been a feature of your life?
I think looking back, it has, but only in kind of small ways. When I was a kid, I was very like clingy to my mum and, you know, got very nervous going to school for the first time, but it was never that bad. And then when I was 14, I got really, really sick. I had an operation that went wrong. So I was in chronic pain and couldn't walk and was sort of misdiagnosed for almost 3 years. And I had to drop out of school and I lost all my friends. And I experienced a lot of medical abuse and a lot of kind of just very horrible things, you know, at that prime age when everything seems to matter more than anything else. Like, it's so funny, I talk to my therapist and I'm like, how am I not over this yet? It's been 12 years. And she's like, because the things that happen at that age stick with you, you know, in a way that other times of your life don't really.
It was astonishing to learn that like our prefrontal cortex isn't fully in function mode until we're 25. Like, so that's a lot of years of things having a really large impact on you if they go south, if they don't work out.
Totally. And it's actually been really interesting for me with the pandemic, because I feel I had a kind of parallel experience 10 years ago where I was incredibly isolated, very sick and a lot of pain. I think when you're sick, especially when you're a kid, there's always this thing of like, stay strong, stay positive. So I was always like, I'm fine, I'm positive. And I started a knitting blog because knitting was the only thing I could do from my bed. And, you know, I started writing and I was out of school, but I became very obsessive about reading and kind of what we've all been doing the pandemic. But then when I had another operation finally when I was 17 and the pain went away. And it was, you know, everything I'd been wanting for the last 3 years. And I had a complete breakdown. Like, I started to have panic attacks. I started to have incredibly bad PTSD and depression. And then I couldn't leave the house again for about another 2 years, because every time I stepped out my front door, I had a panic attack. The depression would just sort of engulf me. And I couldn't speak. I couldn't move. And so the last, you know, that the really bad period, I think, ended when I was like 19, but I'd say the last 7 years, I do still struggle with anxiety, depression, PTSD, OCD, lots of labels. And it's just been really figuring out how to manage that, how to not put pressure on myself, but slowly like reintegrate into the real world, which is so weird because it's what everyone's going through now. So I feel like I've been through this and it's really hard.
It's a lot of heavy stuff to deal with. Going back to the second surgery, have you since gotten clarity on why you felt like you did after that, when you had gotten, I guess, the physical results that you had hoped to achieve?
I think it was just that thing of like, I'd been holding on for 3 years. Like, I'd been fighting so hard, you know, against the pain, against all these physical things. I was in a wheelchair. I was constantly being told that like my mindset was a part of my illness. You know, I was told for a long time that I was like making up my illness, and I was told that I was, you know, all this horrible stuff. And so I think there was this real pressure on me not to show weakness, not to show that I was finding this hard. Like, it was just a physical problem and I was fine. And I think once that ended, it was just this release. And it was just this, like, I'd been holding on for so long, and suddenly all these mental health things that I'd been pushing down for so long just exploded. And I also think I'd been isolated for so long, and I hadn't really sort of, I guess, clocked how, and this is why I keep saying to people, like, we need to take it slow. We need to be gentle on ourselves during now, because I had not like hung out with a group of people. I hadn't been to a restaurant. I hadn't done all these things in so long. And so the overwhelm was just like more than I could handle.
It makes complete sense. I mean, when you describe it like that, of course, that's how your body and your mind reacted. Your body had your back. I guess a certain amount of adrenaline kept you going. And then it's like when we stop for Christmas break and everyone gets sick.
Yes.
Whatever is unprocessed just swoops in and says, you have to deal with me now.
Yeah.
It sounds like so much of your suffering could really have been avoided were it not for like this culture of toxic positivity. Do you believe that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, completely. And I think it's a real, real issue around physical illness in particular, because, you know, we hear all these stories, which are brilliant, of, you know, people going through horrific physical times and they were so strong that they survived, right? And like, we've got all this language, like, you fought this illness and you didn't give in to it and you know, stayed strong and she stayed positive and you know, they were smiling the whole way through. And I remember, like, you know, I would read all these things about people who like did the marathon even though they'd like lost a leg or something. And it's like, who can be the strongest sick person? Who can be the best? And you know, I, before I got sick, I was at this, you know, very high pressured all girls school, and I definitely have like, you know, I have OCD and I definitely have like a perfectionist mindset. And so I think I got really into that, and no one wants you to just, you know, I remember adults would come and everyone was also so scared to talk to me. They didn't really want to like bring up what was going on. And I was like, well, I have nothing else going on. So then I have nothing to talk about. And no one, everyone's so terrified of illness. Like, I think as a culture, we are so scared of physical illness of any kind. Able-bodied people, you know, are so terrified of anything happening. And if you say, I remember if I said to anyone, like, actually, it's just really crap and I'm really unhappy and my back hurts all the time and I want to cry all the time, like their face would just go white as a sheet and they wouldn't know how to respond. So instead I had to say like, I'm good, I'm fighting, you know, and people come to you with these stories as well. Like, I remember there was this one where it was like this girl who had been out of school and she'd used the time she was sick to read the entire works of Shakespeare. And I just remember that sticking in my head. And every time I was like watching Grey's Anatomy or, you know, playing a video game, I was like, why am I not reading the entire works of Shakespeare? And yeah, I think we, you know, the mental health conversation is so nuanced. And I think it's really tough because a lot of this speaking out about mental health has begun with kind of white privileged people like myself, because it's much easier for us to speak out. And there are so many crevices and cracks of this conversation that we really don't talk about. And I think mental health and disability is a huge one, mental health and illness. And yeah, I think, you know, I made this book, It's Not Okay to Feel Blue and Other Lies. And the point of that was just to show how this kind of paradox where mental health can affect everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone necessarily in the same ways. And we need to be having like many conversations, which your podcast does so well.
Oh, thank you. I think there's one thing to, as an individual, to learn to be more understanding of your own mental health, just your health in general, and kind to yourself and have compassion. But we're also uncomfortable with other people's discomfort, and that feeds into the stigma that then feeds back into you having to make that person feel comfortable, even though you're the one not feeling good. It's a collective issue, I think, that we have to address.
It really is.
And if only you were able to say, yeah, like, it feels crap. And it's not about being negative. It's not negative or positive. It's just authentic. It's just being how you are, as you are when you feel it. And it doesn't have to be colored one way or the other.
The toxic positivity is such a real thing. And I think it's such a good phrase. Like,
yeah,
social media has come up with some bad phrases, but it's such a good one because it is. And the thing that I think I learned from all that time is two things. If you know someone's going through something hard, talk to them about it. Like, they will tell you if they don't want to talk about it. But we definitely, especially in England, we have this, or in the UK, we have this culture of like, I didn't want to bring it up. I didn't want to remind her of it. And it's like, yeah, I'm in pain 24 hours a day, and I don't think you're going to remind me of it. Like, I think I'm already thinking about it. So you can bring it up, let them know it's okay for them to talk about it. And then the second thing was, if someone says to you, like, I'm feeling really terrible and this is going on, as it's so tempting to go, well, at least, you know, at least you look great, or at least you've got this, or it will get better. But I just now say, like, I am so sorry you're going through that, and that's really shit, and like, you don't deserve it, you don't deserve it, and I'm really sorry. And I would actually find, when I was sick, if someone said to me, you know, oh, but things are going to be better soon, or you seem better, I would go really negative. I would be like, well, no, they're actually not, and everything's terrible, and, you know, blah, blah. Whereas if someone said to me, like, that sounds so terrible, I'm so sorry, I'd be like, yeah, it is, but, you know, at least I've got my family, and I've just read this great book, and, like, let's talk. Like, it actually, it helps you then focus on the positive, because you know the negative's been acknowledged.
I think it's so important to always make space for the negative, because then when you do feel positive after, it's not like you're shoving it down your throat. You can actually consider the positive side of things from a perspective of, well, at least I've given some oxygen to how I really feel.
Can I ask you a question? Because I'm really interested in this just from your podcast, and it's something I've like struggled with for a long time. But with the kind of mental health conversation, and especially like solutions to mental health,
mm-hmm.
I find sometimes that can become a pressure in itself. Like, I remember when I was first, you know, when I ended up going to a like depression treatment center for a long time, which I was very privileged to be able to do. And then when I came out of that, and there were, I would wake up and write this sort of insane to-do list of things I needed to do, you know, find a therapist, meditate for half an hour a day, exercise, make sure I get my sunshine, make sure I have a conversation with someone, eat well, drink lots of water, stand on your head for 30 minutes. Like, that, you can be so bombarded with these things that we're supposed to be doing to help our mental health. And I have definitely gone through phases of my life where, like, I was doing too much, and it would, that in itself was becoming a problem. You know,
yeah.
I was doing acupuncture, I was trying to meditate, I was, you know, obsessively drinking water and eating healthily and doing all this, and waking up at this time and going to sleep at this time and not being on my phone at this time. And it actually in the end meant I was sort of thinking about my mental health like 24/7.
Yeah.
And you know, you speak to so many people who have different solutions. How do you kind of manage knowing all of those solutions and finding what works for you?
I always take solutions with a pinch of salt. I think for me, the biggest solution of all has been to just, like the title, just to own it and accept the presence of anxiety in a human being's life and to roll with it. And I think I remember being so desperate for the cure or the fix all. And I think so many people arrive at that point, and like, I get so many DMs being like, what's the one thing I can do for social anxiety? Or what's the one thing I can do for this? First of all, I'm not the expert. I just try to like bridge the gap between experts and people who need help. But for me, it's always just about knowledge. And I think understanding the mechanisms of anxiety. Like, I'm so interested in the brain, and everything you were describing there, like, to me just makes so much sense. And that knowledge alone, plus the bit of self-compassion, that's like my biggest combination to dissolve anxiety, plus medication. So like, I'm still on medication for anxiety. I've been on it for a few years, and I've done episodes on that as well. And I think there's a lot of stigma around that, but I think I'm someone who really needed help medically to get to a sense of even keel, where things like going for a walk and yoga and stuff would benefit me. I feel like this, the commoditization of self-care has become such an issue that like what was meant as the antidote has become part of the problem.
100%. Like, it's become the pressure. And I think it's so important to say to people, like, find what works for you. Don't just follow what works, you know, because you get these people who, like, and I really get it. Like, I'm not judging anyone, but it's like they've found what works for you, and then they're telling you that it's the absolute be all end all fix. And the way that I kind of have split it up in my head is like, there's two levels for me of looking after my mental health. There are the things that keep me on an even keel. And like when I'm feeling good, I know that they are going to probably extend how long I feel good for. So that's things like exercise, yoga. That might not work for you. Your things might be meditation and spending time alone, whatever it is. And then I have what me and my mum call state of emergency, which is when the depression hits or the anxiety hits. And in that case, suddenly exercise makes things worse, you know, because I'm exercising and it's making me more panicked and it's making me more stressed. And to be totally honest, and like, I find this really hard to talk about because it's not something you'd put in like a lovely infographic post, that, you know, whatever. But when I'm in that place and I have, you know, been going through this for a decade now, the things that help is I cancel my plans, I get into bed, I play a game on my phone and I watch something on TV, and I do that until the depression passes. And it's not, you know, meditating. It's not like having a lovely bath with bath salts.
See, you have to remember that there is a capitalism element to it, though, like the bath salts and everything, it's all to sell products. So we've lost the self element of self-care, I think.
Yes.
Like you, when I feel bad, I clear my diary and I will get into bed and I will watch, like, I'm obsessed with Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Yeah, me too.
Both of us now obviously have enough awareness that we're not going to be like, oh, I better subscribe to someone else's idea of self-care or the public perception of what self-care could be. And it's, for me, it's such a slippery slope, because then the self-care becomes another tool to measure your self-worth against.
I want to just say, because I was in that place where like I truly felt like I was failing at fixing my depression, you know, and that is something you should never. I also want to say, by the way, I'm on medication and I see a therapist once a week, which I'm so lucky to have found a medication and found a therapist that works for me. And those are the two like real baseline things. Like, I think a lot of this self-care stuff doesn't include medication, and it's like, I wouldn't be here without medication. But, you know, I think like, especially my mom is always dreaming that there is going to be this like secret fix that's just going to cure me. And I think another huge thing for me was realizing that I'm going to live with these things for my whole life. Like, they'll come and go. And hopefully, like, as I get older, you know, I'll find even more tools and even more things that will mean it's even more manageable. But like, I'm never going to find a fix. My mum will always buy me a vitamin supplement that she's found, and she's like, this might fix it. And I'm like, I love you so much, but this is the way my brain works, and like, I can manage it, but I've really, it's taken me a long time, but I'm finally in a place where like, I can ignore some of that sort of screaming pressure that like, you're not doing the right thing to fix your mental health. I think we're having a real moment of that with screen time, you know, like, get off your phone before bed and don't use your phone in the morning. And I'm just like, that, I don't do that. Like, I do not monitor my screen time. Like, I just can't. And that would add an extra pressure, and I would be judging myself on my screen time. And I don't need any more sticks to beat myself with, you know?
For me, the biggest learning, especially in the last few years, has been the science of self-compassion. And I did an episode with Dr. Kristen Neff, who is the first person to have conceptually defined it in like a very clear way. We think we're being self-motivating by saying, oh, just come on, get up out of bed and just get on when it feels better. We're doing the opposite. We're making ourselves feel worse. We're like scolding a child. So the one question I say to myself when I start to feel a bit overwhelmed is like, what do I need right now? I don't care what you think I need. What do I need? Sometimes that is getting in a bath. Sometimes it's watching crappy TV. Sometimes it's putting on comfy pyjamas. It doesn't have to be what you think it should look like. And how can I support myself in this moment? And how can I comfort myself? That self-compassion has really brought me to a point where anxiety is something that I can so swiftly move through as and when it comes. And that's the thing, it does come because life is stressful and things happen. And I think I've got a kind of tendency towards anxiety as well. But I think the biggest solution is, ironically, getting to a point of acceptance of where you are.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. That is I think of everything I've ever done, self-compassion is the one thing that's helped me manage this more than anything. I also think, you know, a lot of my diagnoses, you know, people have different thoughts about diagnoses, and I think in some ways they can help and whatever, but you know, I do struggle with OCD, and that means that, like, I am at risk for getting very obsessive about these things. And I've got a friend who's got a sort of similar form of OCD to me, and he was looking into sleep trackers, and I sort of sat down with him and I was like, look, this will become another thing, another stick you use to beat yourself with, another way that you measure yourself, another thing you can fail at. And I, you know, that's one of the things I like know I have to avoid, because I, you know, I think I sleep fine. I don't know. I used to have really bad insomnia. I still take sleeping pills quite a lot of the time. Like, I've figured out a way that works for me, but it's just sometimes not all these things need to be monitored and tracked and perfected.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I think my experience has been mostly anxiety. And then I think as a result of that being so bad, sometimes I have felt depressed, or I was diagnosed as depressed. How do you differentiate between the two? Like, what does an anxious day feel like versus a depressed day, or do they ever come together?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because I actually think it's not talked about that much. And I think I started noticing a lot of the more general, like, public conversation we were having around mental health was more about anxiety. I definitely have, like, anxiety most days, you know, and some days it's just like little nerves. I have a real issue with the moment of opening the door and stepping out of my house. It's so weird, but, like, once I'm literally out the door, I'm fine. But sometimes I'll stand by the door for like 5 or 10 minutes, just like that thing of opening the door makes me quite anxious. And then it will sometimes be really bad and I'll have panic attacks. But with the depression, I think this is important. I have depressive episodes. So what that means is, you know, at the moment, I think I have, it's more around like once or twice a year. And for me, they normally start at night and things will just start to get really bad. And then when I'm in them, the closest thing, I've never even like really used drugs, but it's a bit like being completely high or completely, my brain is not my brain. Like it, I can't think, I can't speak. Everything, every single thing that I think of goes dark. Like, you know, I'll look at a flower and think about death. I'll look at like my, it's just incredibly, incredibly dark. I can't really move. I can't shower. Like it just gets very, very dark. And it's very different from anxiety. And it took me quite a long time to kind of figure out the difference between them, because often with anxiety, like I can push through it, but with the depressive episodes, there kind of just isn't much I can do. Like, and you know, I've had it diagnosed as chronic depression with depressive episodes, and all I can really do is, as I said, sit in bed, watch some crappy TV. And I have found for me that the main solution is to really just distract myself as much as I can, because anytime I'm thinking, it's very, very dark and it can lead me down a very, very dark path. So, you know, I play on my Nintendo Switch, I play Candy Crush, I watch a TV show, I, you know, make sure that I'm getting food and water and staying alive. And it, when you're in it, it feels like it is never going to go away. Like sometimes the last time I had it, I would think about the person I was like a few days earlier when I wasn't in it, and it would feel like a stranger. Like I remember looking at pictures in my phone being like, who is that? Like I could never have been that person. And the idea of being out of it is impossible. You're like, I am never gonna not feel this way. And for me, what happens is after hopefully a few days, sometimes a few weeks, like I think the longest I've had is maybe 6 weeks, which was horrific, but only happened once, but it just starts to lift. And when it lifts, it is black and white. Like it's the, that's kind of an incredible feeling. It's like suddenly someone turns the lights on. And they're really, really hard. And it's been really hard for me to accept that that's a part of my life, because, you know, I am a control freak and there's just nothing I can do to control that.
And there must be a lot of anxiety anticipating if one is going to come along.
Oh, completely. And coming out of them is really hard, because it's almost like being a newborn baby, like getting back into the world, you know. There's not really like an upside or like a nice little button that I can put on the end of it. But interestingly, as you were saying about self-compassion, the biggest thing that has helped me with them is to know that it's a part of my diagnosis, it's a part of my brain. But also they always end. That's something I have to say to myself again and again. I'm like, they always end. They always end.
I learned eventually, and I could only learn this in time after experiencing it for quite a long time, was just knowing, okay, how you feel right now is not how you're going to feel in the future. So just allow yourself to feel it now and trust that it will lift.
Oh, hell yes. And also I almost call it being possessed, and I get possessed by the anxiety and I get possessed by the depression. And it's really funny, like the last time I had one of these, I moved back in with my parents, because, you know, they could help me like get food and stuff. And my mum would come in and she'd be like, do you want to talk? And I would have to say like, no, because anything we talk about, the possessed depression demon will come out. And I've been in this situation before where I start saying things that I know I don't believe, you know, and I know aren't true, but any path that I go down of thought or speak is going to be bad. So the way I've had to do it, and it's a lot of compartmentalizing, is just literally ignoring those thoughts. And I see it sometimes with my friends where like I know that they're in an anxious place and they'll start to sort of ask questions or try and go down a rabbit hole, and I'm just like, you have to ignore these thoughts, because you are not going to think those things in tomorrow or the next day or whenever this ends. And the more you indulge those thoughts in that moment, at least for me, the worse it's going to get, you know, because I start saying things like, you know, I have no talent, I'm terrible at my job, I need to quit it. And then someone says, no, you're not, you're great. And I go, you're lying. It's like being possessed.
I literally used to describe it like paranormal activity. That's how I imagined like anxiety, when I felt like I just had so little control. But part of that lack of control was a lack of awareness and understanding for me. And the education piece for me has been the most confidence building. I feel equipped because I can understand what's going on. It doesn't mean that they don't come. I know what's going to make me feel maybe not better, but more comfortable in the moment. And they're the life rafts that we cling to. They're the things that you don't see on social media that really do make the difference.
Yeah, totally. And I've just had to learn, you know, I've learned what intrusive thoughts feel like. I've learned how to ignore them. I've learned I think it just takes time. Like everyone's mental illness is different. And it's just exactly as you said, learning, experiencing it, knowing, you know, for me, there's not a ton I can do to make it better, but there's a lot I can do not to make it worse.
How has it been navigating these experiences being in the public eye, having grown up with your father and Hollywood and everything? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think one thing is like, I don't really think of myself as in the public eye, even though I know that I kind of am. But I think I feel very lucky to have quite a good relationship with that side of things. And I'm like, you know, I started blogging when I was 15. So I was always like a person of the internet. And then I started sharing about my mental health when I was like 19, just because it was actually, you know, I was so ashamed of it. And I wasn't really talking to anyone in my real life about it. And I was like, well, maybe the one way to get over this shame is to talk about it online. And I love that. I love like being able to share things and knowing that other people feel the same way. And every time I do it, it feels like I'm extinguishing this little fire of shame inside me, you know. But I do also, I never feel pressure to post. I never feel like I owe anyone anything. You know, I've taken big breaks before. I think something that I'm sure you have, I found it, you know, I grew up in an incredibly privileged position. And one part of that is like, you know, my dad is a man called Richard Curtis. He makes some very lovely films, but they're very happy films. And my family is very luckily like a very happy family, and they're all very positive. And I think for a long time, I really felt like I was this like dark cloud in our house, you know, like I was the one person in my community that was going through all these problems, and for some reason couldn't handle life and couldn't be happy when everyone else could, and you know that everyone else was kind of, that I was failing in that way, and I think that's been quite hard and has taken a lot of, like, in a funny way, and I think they'd agree, like me educating my parents on how, and I think often that's what you have to do when you're someone going through mental illness, is like, unfortunately, you have to slightly be the one to educate the people in your life on how to deal with you when you're in that state and when you're in that situation.
The anxiety of what other people that matter to you think about you, or if they think, oh, she just needs to have a cup of tea and just shake it off and get on with it, that just like compounds it more. So you're absolutely right. Like, there's a lot of work and pressure on the individual to then educate those around her. I hope that the people in your life were as receptive as the people in mine to understanding, okay, it's not just that you're in a bad mood, or it's not just that you're a bit of a worrier.
Yeah.
You don't want to feel this way or think this way, but you do, and it's not pleasant. Do you feel like you've a good relationship there with your family?
Yeah. I mean, now it's not been easy. Like, it's definitely been tough, both on my side and their side. You know, I think for a long time, and this is really dark and like, you know, but I think a lot of people feel this way, but I felt like if I wasn't here, you'd all be so much happier. You know, I was like looking at my like lovely, happy, cheery family, and just, I was up in bed crying and unable to get out of bed. And I was like, God, I'm the bad thing. And realizing that's not the case, obviously, has been huge. And then, yeah, just really sort of helping my parents understand, you know, and sometimes it is, and this feels weird, but sometimes it is literally breaking it down for them and saying like, okay, when I'm going through a depressive episode, I need you to not propose solutions. I need you to not tell me to just get out of bed and have a walk and do this. Like, this is what I need you to do. And I am so lucky and grateful that they have now really, really responded to that and really get it. And I think it's helped them understand themselves a bit more. And you know, I've got three younger brothers, and two of them are quite a lot younger than me and have grew up with me like being very physically sick or mentally ill. And like my brother's joke, I was just their sister crying and screaming in the bedroom with the closed door. But they now understand it more than anyone. And like my little brother Spike, who's like my favorite human in the world, will like, you know, he'll come in and he'll say like, is today a sad day? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, do you want to talk, or do you want a hug, or do you just want me to sit here? And I'm like, yeah, that would be really nice. And they really get it. And they can also like kind of make fun of it, which is also good. Cause I think so often like this stuff can feel so like heavy and weighted, and they sometimes just think I'm like hilarious for all my different like needs and madnesses. And that has helped me so much, like to just be able to see it as part of my life and part of our family instead of this stain on our family, you know?
Those beliefs that we build from a young age can really determine a lot of our experience in adulthood. And I don't doubt that your family see you as anything other than such a bright spark in their life. And look at all the wonderful work you've done to normalize mental health for people. Like, I just had to stop in my tracks when I saw the billboard for the Christmas one.
Yeah.
And how much pressure people feel at that time of year. And oh my God, you've done so much work, maybe even unbeknownst to yourself, to make people more accepting of where they're at. And it's really generous of you to share as much as you share.
I do want to say one thing about that billboard. So with the book that we did about mental health, we put up this billboard that said, it's okay if it's not the happiest time of year around Christmas. And I did feel like that was a bit of me like making up for the sins of my father, because my dad made Love Actually, which is a wonderful film and I do love it, but I do think it puts a lot of pressure on people to like feel happy at Christmas. And I've had a lot of very sad Christmases where I was like, well, I'm definitely not in Love Actually right now.
You were in Love Actually as well, weren't you?
I was actually in Love Actually. I was the second lobster. Not the main lobster. I was the second lobster, but you can see me. I think I was like 8 years old.
I would love to just wrap up by asking you, if you could go back in time, having the awareness that you have now and the understanding that you have now, what would you say to yourself in maybe your experience of your first panic attack?
We've sort of talked about this, but I would say, firstly, you're not alone, and a lot of other people are going through this, because I think when I first started going through this, I truly thought I had like invented anxiety. Like, I just didn't know anyone else had ever felt this way. I would say you're gonna get better, so don't put pressure on yourself to get better, and it's okay if you're not feeling better. I think especially when I was going through like the period of real intense bad mental health, I would always be trying to say like, it's getting better, you know, and I'm feeling better and it's fine. And the reality was I wasn't, and I wish I had just let myself be in that place, and like you said, had the self-compassion, done the things that helped, you know, stayed in bed, like instead of constantly trying to push through it and pretend that things were getting better when they really weren't.
It's so important. I hope at least in your mind's eye, you can go back in time and give yourself a little hug and apply some retrospective self-compassion. But Scarlett, thank you so much for sharing with me today. I can't wait to share this with my listeners. I know it will help them feel less alone. I've loved chatting to you. I feel like we could have hours and hours of podcast.
I know, truly. I could talk to you forever. Thank you so much. What you do is so important. I have loved this.
Thank you. That means the world.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.